tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest
news
headlines.
Intelligence and security officials in the U.S. government and private sector have cautiously marveled at the seemingly slow pace of Russian cyber attacks and influence operations using social media. Unlike in the run-up to the 2016 U.S. presidential elections, officials say so far there has been no frenzy of attacks, phishing attacks, or use of ads and false news stories to penetrate voting systems, alter voter rolls, or influence voters ahead of the upcoming midterm elections. President Donald Trump said Saturday that his personal lawyers' taping of their private phone conversations is totally unheard of and perhaps illegal. He was responding to the revelation that former attorney Michael Cohen, weeks before the 2016 election, secretly recorded their discussion of a potential payment for a former Playboy model's account of having an affair with Mr. Trump. As AP correspondent Jonathan Lemire reports, President Trump's attorney, Rudy Giuliani, is putting his spin on Michael Cohen's recordings.
He confirms that this conversation happened, that Cohen and Trump spoke about 2 months before the election. But first of all, it was brief. And second of all, though a payment to McDougal was discussed, it was never acted upon. And, Giuliani's version, if this were to have happened, Trump would have wanted it done the right way, via check, so there'd be a record, and therefore not be an attempt to skirt some sort of campaign finance law.
AP's Jonathan Lemire, the recording was part of a large collection of documents and electronic records seized by federal authorities from the longtime Trump fixer earlier this year. Hamas said Saturday that it has a truce with Israel following months of increasing tensions. On Saturday morning, however, an Israeli tank fired on a Hamas post in Gaza after Palestinians attempted to breach the border. There were no reported injuries or fatalities. The announcement of the ceasefire comes a day after an Israeli soldier was shot dead and four Palestinians killed along the volatile Gaza border. This is VOA News. During a series of quick meetings at the UN in New York, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo insisted that the international community must continue to keep the pressure on North Korea leader Kim Jong-un to denuclearize.
Chairman Kim made a promise. Chairman Kim told not only President Trump, but President Moon, that he was prepared to denuclearize. The scope and scale of that is agreed to. The North Koreans understand what that means.
Secretary Pompeo warned North Korea is trying to get around sanctions smuggling petroleum products into the country by sea at levels that exceed what is allowed under international sanctions. The United States has asked the UN Security Council committee that monitors sanctions implementation to ban further fuel shipments to Pyongyang in a bid to cut off revenue to its nuclear and ballistic missile programs. A physicians group working with Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh says medical and scientific evidence indicates the extent of the violence they suffered at the hands of the Myanmar military and civilians. And please tell the world what they've done to us, Physicians for Human Rights detailed the findings of forensic medical evaluations of 22 Rohingya survivors of an August 2017 assault on the village north of Rakhine State. More than 3 years of war has pushed Yemen to the brink of famine, with more than 8 million people extremely hungry, people totally dependent on international aid for their survival as well. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA in Geneva.
But World Food Program spokeswoman Bettina Lucia tells VOA heavy fighting around this strategic city is putting the delivery of crucial aid at risk.
We are continuing to provide emergency rations to the people fleeing the violence, and we are making sure that wheat and other food stocks are available. We are concerned that the upsurge in the fighting in Hodeidah could lead to 1.1 million people being either displaced or trapped within Hodeidah. That's the concern that we have.
The United Nations reports an estimated 50,000 Yemenis have been newly displaced since fighting broke out in Hodeidah on June 12th.
Lisa Schlein reporting for VOA. Several of Colombia's former leftist guerrillas have been sworn in as members of the legislature. They took their places Friday under the terms of a peace accord that ended a 50-year war and gave the former FARC rebels 5 seats in both the upper and lower chambers of Congress. A report by UNAIDS warns that the global response to HIV is at a critical point. Eastern and Southern Africa remain the regions most affected by the HIV epidemic. It accounts for 45% of the world's HIV infections and 53% of people with HIV globally. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
There is a high likelihood that certain things are going to change. For instance, the ballot papers, which we claim they have already been printed, but opposition is saying instead of two columns, they want one column.
Zimbabwean political parties campaign before the upcoming general election.
Partnership with China is based on mutual trust and respect, and we appreciate that. This is why this cooperation has been increasing for the past year.
Chinese President Xi Jinping plans to visit Rwanda Sunday for a two-day state visit.
Mandela, for example, he fought for democracy. In the feeling of Mandela, democracy was the basis for the other aspects to go on.
And millions around the world mark the Nelson Mandela International Day. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Zimbabwean political parties are campaigning nationwide ahead of the July 30 general election. President Emmerson Mnangagwa from the ruling ZANU-PF party is expected to face a stiff competition from Nelson Chamisa, leader of the main opposition movement for democratic change, or MDCT, in the presidential vote. This, as a recent poll shows, that President Mnangagwa's lead over challenger Chamisa has shrunk from 11 to just 3 percentage points since May. For the latest update, I read Rejoice Ngwenya, a Zimbabwean political analyst in the capital, Harare.
The momentum of political campaigns has reached a crescendo, and Zimbabweans are excited and expectant. You know, there's so much enthusiasm and the large crowds that are following the big parties like MDC Alliance and ZANU-PF. It's almost a celebratory mood. Of course, the issue of the administrative side of the elections themselves and the arguments against the Zimbabwe Elections Commission have not stopped, and it's creating a kind of an anticlimax.
I understand some parties have taken the Electoral Commission to court about how it's going about organizing the anticipated July 30 elections, but how are people reacting to all these so-called drama ahead of the election?
The ZEC is facing a litany of accusations and litigation on different aspects. Some of them are brought about by the parties, others by individuals. But the average person in the street is still convinced that despite those hurdles that are being put by ZEC, mostly to do with the perceived collusion between, Priscilla Chigumba, the chairperson of ZEC, and, of course, the incumbent president, Mnangagwa. But the information on the ground is people are enthusiastic and very keen to go and vote and prove a point.
Have they been reassured that the upcoming elections will be organized in a free, fair, transparent manner, and that the outcome will be acceptable to a majority of Zimbabweans, that their vote really counted?
Inevitably, you are going to get two camps. The camps that are pro-establishment, that argue that the Zimbabwe Election Commission is an independent institution that has the mandate and the capacity to manage the elections, and they are quite happy with the procedures and processes. And, of course, there's the other camp, the opposition camp, that still argues that despite the electoral demands being whittled down from 10 to 2, the commission is still arrogant and intransigent. And that is the side that is insisting that they don't feel that the elections are going to be a process that's not going to yield a dispute. So there is a high possibility that whatever result is announced, there will be some kind of dispute that is associated with the previous complaints about the partisan way in which ZEC has managed these elections.
Talking about foreign observers coming to Zimbabwe, what are the expectations that their presence could also nudge the Electoral Commission to ensure that the elections are free, fair, and transparent?
This is a fantastic question, because there was an assumption that if the foreign observers, long-term observers, are in town, there could be a drastic change in certain electoral regulations which suits the expectations of the opposition. But that has not happened. Of course, we have heard of one or two press conferences by the EU, by the elders, and so forth, but none of those press conferences give me confidence that Priscilla Chikumba will change anything. Unless, of course, these negotiations are being done behind closed doors. But from a view outside, I do not see the presence of the foreign observers having had any influence in the manner that Priscilla Chikumba is conducting herself.
Is the Electoral Commission addressing concerns of political parties in the run-up to the election just to ensure that Zimbabweans are confident that the elections will be credible?
The Commission has, in the past few days, showed some visible signs of anxiety, especially when Nelson Chamisa and the MDC Alliance alleged that they were going to picket the offices until their two demands have been met. So the chairperson has been talking about the possibility of reconvening the multi-party committee that discusses these things. So there is some visible signs that they are willing to talk about it, but she still insists that there are things that are to do with the law that she cannot change. But if the MDC Alliance pushes through its picketing agenda on Tuesday, there is a high likelihood that certain things are going to change. For instance, the ballot papers, which she claimed had already been printed, but opposition is saying instead of two columns, they want one column. So there are things that I feel that she might not have a choice if she doesn't want to face a total rebellion of non-participation of MDC Alliance.
Rejoice Ngwenya is a Zimbabwean political analyst. He spoke with me from Harare. Meanwhile, an international non-profit organization called The Eldest is assessing the situation in the lead-up to the Zimbabwean elections. The group is made up of elderly statesmen, peace activists, human rights advocates, and other public figures. For VOA reporter Kutsazai's Vanavashi has more from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
The leader and chairperson of the group in Zimbabwe is former United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan.
We are here in solidarity with the people of Zimbabwe. This is a crucial election for the country, perhaps as crucial as the first election following independence. You are at crossroads, and the direction you decide to move in is going to be extremely important. And all of you, every Zimbabwean, has a role to play.
Annan says every Zimbabwean should participate in the forthcoming elections. He commended the peace that has prevailed on the eve of July 30th polls. In the same breath, he urged politicians to reject insults and big man politics.
In our discussions with political leaders and civil society, but mainly with political leaders, we did urge them to watch the language they use. We can disagree without insulting each other. And I hope that's the direction we would go. You should also try in the last days to encourage the political leaders to talk to you about programs. Let's move away from personalities.
He notes that there has been some improvement in Zimbabwe's political landscape, despite some reports of violence and intimidation. The first woman president of Ireland and former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Mary Robinson, is a member of the Elders. She says it is praiseworthy that a sizable number of women and young people are registered to vote, but says she has reservations over the abuse the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission female commissioners have faced on social media.
They have been vilified on social media and even threatened. This is not acceptable at all. Yes, you can criticize an electoral commission for not playing a proactive role. That's fair game. That's allowed. But it's not allowed to vilify on social media or elsewhere.
She says they have noted that the few female political players have been subjected to the same abuse and urged the media to take a proactive role in defending women's rights. During Robert Mugabe's rule, the elders were denied entry into the country. Their visit, which included a meeting with the Zimbabwe president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, hints at the positive changes Anan spoke about. The group leaves today. In his parting words, Anan said they will remain committed to the people of Zimbabwe. They would keep up with the developments in the country and help in any way possible. For VOA, this is Kudzai Shinawashe from Harare.
Chinese President Xi Jinping is expected to visit Rwanda Sunday for a two-day state visit. The Rwandan State Minister for Foreign Affairs, Olivier Nduhungirehe, said that during the visit, a number of bilateral agreements on trade, investment and infrastructure will be signed. This is the first time that a Chinese president will be visiting Rwanda. For more, Edward Rema from VOA Central Africa Service reached Mr. Nduhungirehe in the Rwandan capital, Kigali.
This will be an important visit, a historical visit, because it will be the first time that the Chinese president visits Rwanda. We are happy for that, because this visit will strengthen the bilateral relations between the two countries, but also economic partnership and investment between the two countries. During that visit, there will be about 15 agreements and projects that will be signed between China and Rwanda, including an agreement on mutual visa exemption for holders of diplomatic and service passport, an agreement on a framework of a Silk Road economic belt, an agreement on investment, and many others. So it will be an important moment to strengthen our cooperation and also to open the doors for an increase of investment between our two countries.
Honorable Minister, some other people also say that the fact that China is expanding footprint in Africa shows that African countries are trying to stay away from the West.
No, African countries are not staying away from the West. And Rwanda is not staying away from the West. We have cooperation with China and with other countries, but we didn't cut any partnership with European countries and North American countries. What we want as a country is the interest of our people, is the interest of our project, economic projects, social projects, and we are partnering with different countries from east to west, and we will continue to do so.
What would you say to people who say that the reason you're working closely with China is because you don't want to be accountable to issues related to human rights, lack of democracy, especially in so many African countries?
No, that is not true, because we didn't stop any partnership with the European Union, with the European countries, with the U.S. and other countries. But we know, of course, that partnership with China is based on mutual trust and respect, and we appreciate that. This is why this cooperation has been increasing for the past year.
Minister Olivier Nduhungirehe, thank you so much for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Olivier Nduhungirehe is the Rwandan State Minister for Foreign Affairs. He spoke with viewers Edward Rema from Kigali. The U.S. government has launched Connect Africa, a program that would invest more than $1 billion in projects to improve transportation, communications, and value chains across the continent. For VOA, Halima Tumani reports from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
The U.S. government will carry out the initiative through its development finance branch, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation. Over the next 3 years, OPIC plans to finance projects with companies in Zambia, Rwanda, South Africa, Kenya, and Uganda. Speaking at a news conference in Kampala this week, OPIC Chief Executive Officer Ray Washburn explained how the investments will help economic expansion in Africa.
give us additional capabilities, including equity investing in the projects. And so we are very aggressively looking throughout Africa for projects, and Uganda is very high on our list. Our primary objective is to bring force multiplier, to bring other capital to the market, to show other people the U.S. is committed to this region. In addition to that, we also want to be a multiplier for jobs.
Early this month, OPIC committed $100 million in financing to a cellular communications company that will upgrade and expand telecommunication networks in Uganda, Gambia, Sierra Leone, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. In Uganda, OPIC will invest $58 million in projects that include a hydropower plant. Washburn stressed that by focusing on connectivity, the U.S. is not just helping to build means for economic development, but laying the foundation for future trade partners, including women.
One way to lift women up is communication and, you know, trying to grow their business. They need access to capital. Having access to a bank account has been very difficult in the past. Now with mobile phone and having banking on your phone that you can transact that way, really open it up, especially in the smaller villages for women, because now their bank account is in their pocket.
However, the Ugandan government recently imposed a tax on the use of mobile money applications. Washburn said he could not comment on local government laws. The $1 billion in financing is small compared to $60 billion that China has promised to invest in Africa. Asked to compare the U.S. presence in Africa to China's, Washburn said other countries focus more on infrastructure, while the U.S. is focusing its investments on consumers and small or medium-sized businesses to help people further down the economic food chain. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
A report by UNAIDS, Miles to Go, Closing Gaps, Breaking Barriers, Righting Injustices, warns that the global response to HIV is at a critical point. Eastern and Southern Africa remain the regions most affected by the epidemic, accounting for 45% of the world's HIV infections and 53% of people living with HIV globally. For VOA, Ryle Ombo reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
An estimated 800,000 people in Eastern and Southern Africa acquired HIV in 2017, and an estimated 380,000 people died of AIDS-related illnesses, the report indicated. Mozambique, South Africa, and Tanzania accounted for more than half of the new HIV infections and deaths from AIDS-related illnesses in the region last year. The survey also indicated that there was discrimination against HIV-positive persons in healthcare settings, especially towards key populations. Key populations include men who have sex with men, drug users, transgender persons, and sex workers, considered to be most at risk at contracting HIV. There are nearly 1 million sex workers estimated to need services in the region. Dr. Kigen Barmasai is the director at Kenya National AIDS and STI Control Program, NASCOP.
For us, it's important. In fact, we do have within NASCOP a key population program, mainly targeting the key populations, the female sex workers, men who have sex with men, and injecting drug users. One, we know that this contributes about 33% of the new infections in Kenya from these key populations. Of course, the prevalence varies. We have prevalence from 29% in female sex workers to 18% among the injecting drug users. So as a program, we actually work on this, and we are spearheading the HIV prevention, treatment and care efforts to reverse the epidemic. For the last 10 years, we've been working on that.
More than half of the people surveyed who inject drugs said they avoided healthcare services, citing discrimination or fear of law enforcement authorities. In Kenya, homosexuality is illegal, and being found guilty can lead to a sentence of up to 14 years in prison. Sex work is also illegal in Kenya. Grace Kamau is chairperson of Key Population Consortium in Kenya.
The criminal nature of key population and the act of key population that makes people shy away from accessing healthcare and even organizing, coming together so that people can organize. So the main thing is the criminal nature, and people fear to be arrested.
The report said about 2/3 of all people living with HIV in the region were accessing antiretroviral therapy in 2017. Kamau attributes the successes in reaching large numbers of key populations in Kenya to availability of HIV resources made possible by donor funding, but she says more people are yet to be reached.
One of the things that we really have in Kenya is the private clinics that are donors funded. That is where the sex workers feel comfortable, and that is where they access services. And that is what has made the number to go high.
The report indicates that there were 19.6 million people living with HIV in Eastern and Southern Africa at the end of 2017. Out of this number, 81% were aware of their HIV status, an increase from 77% in 2016. Western Central Africa continues to lag behind, as statistics indicated AIDS-related deaths have fallen by only 24% in Western and Central Africa, compared to a 42% decline in Eastern and Southern Africa. Nigeria has more than half of the HIV burden in the region, and there has been little progress in reducing new HIV infections there in recent years. Raya Lombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
Cholera outbreak in Cameroon has claimed at least a dozen lives. Hundreds of people have been rushed to several hospitals in the Central African country. It is feared some of the cases were imported from Nigeria and may contaminate refugees fleeing the Boko Haram insurgency. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
Arabo Saadu, the highest government official in charge of health in Cameroon's north region, says the first cases of cholera were reported along Cameroon's border with Nigeria 2 months ago.
Nous avons été notifiés le 18 mai 2018 au district de santé de Mayo-Wulo.
He says the disease has continued to spread since four cases of cholera were recorded in the northern Cameroon town of Mayo-Wulo that borders Nigeria on May 18. He says many people, especially children, have been dying both in and out of hospitals. In May, the World Health Organization reported that Nigeria's Adamawa, Borno, and Yobe states had been experiencing recurrent cholera outbreaks since February, with a total of 1,664 suspected cases and 31 deaths. Many people from the three Nigerian states traveled to Cameroon for business. At least 100,000 are in Cameroon as refugees, fleeing the Boko Haram insurgency, with over 90,000 at the Minawawo refugee camp. Isaac Bayoro, a Cameroonian epidemiologist working in the Mokolo administrative area where the Minawawo refugee camp is located, says they are educating refugees to respect hygiene norms and are also screening Nigerians coming to the camp in a bid to protect not only the refugees, but their host communities.
Les gens comptent quoi des faits qu'à l'air libre.
He says many people continue to defecate in the open air or in streams and riverbeds, where both humans and animals go to find water to drink, thereby facilitating the spread of cholera. He says hygiene is not respected as many people do not wash their hands with soap as advised. He says people should stop trusting the belief that an African is naturally vaccinated and cannot die of dirt. Cameroon's Ministry of Health indicated that the disease quickly spread to Yaoundé and Douala, major cities in the Central African state. The case reported in Yaoundé was of a teenager who traveled to Yaoundé from northern Cameroon with his mother. He later died in a hospital, according to the government. Thomas Tawe, a university student and resident of Yaoundé, says he fears cholera may spread rapidly in the city because just 30% of the population has access to good drinking water.
In the city of Yaoundé, only those who can pay can have water. When you go into the quarters, you see that people are carrying water from very inhygienic sources. If the water is contaminated, automatically will be contaminated.
Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, this week, the world marked the Nelson Mandela International Day. The day Nelson Mandela was born, many celebrate the way Nelson Mandela devoted his life to the service of humanity as a human rights lawyer, a prisoner of conscience, an international peacemaker, and the first democratically elected president of a free South Africa. Suleiman Mugala is a South African-based independent political analyst. My colleague Douglas Mpuga reached him in Durban to find out how the day was celebrated.
It has been a very wonderful week for South Africans, all South Africans, white, black, any color. They have been involved in acts of charity, espousing the values which Mandela espoused. Almost the whole country is involved in that sense. And of course, it was an addition to have Obama, who gave us a very inspiring speech, which actually fired up many people. So in the whole country, I can't say, is fired up to renew, to reactivate, to remember the great man Mandela as he was.
When you talk of Mandela, there are virtues that people want to emphasize. His good deeds, his capacity to forgive and move ahead and unite people. Is this spirit of Mandela alive in South Africa?
If I'm going to take it up from Barack Obama's speech, in a nutshell, he appreciated the strides which South Africa was taking, which are in line with the value which Mandela stood for. But also, he looked at the broader continent and the world at large. He emphasized the decline in democracy, the decline in good governance, the absence of good leaders or worse leaders on the continent and the world at large. So even as far as South Africa is concerned, by and large, we have got the good things for us as a country, but also we mourn the absurd state of the African continent, even as we enjoy the good things given by Mandela to our country, we also look at the absurdness, the state in which the continent is, which is terribly absurd. As far as the continent is, you look at the greed on the continent, you look at corruption on the continent, you look at the heartlessness, the callousness, the cruelty on the continent, you look at the deception, the untrustworthiness, the unpatriotism on the continent, you look at the hollowness, the shamelessness, the dirty spirit of fortune hunters in the leadership on the continent.
The current inequality, the poverty among the majority black people who don't seem to have actually gained economically as far as things are concerned. They got the political freedom and independence right, but the wealth either remained among the white South Africans or the Africans who now moved into their footsteps and amassed wealth and left a majority of people in poverty.
Yeah, I think there is that school of thought, which is held by some people here in South Africa. But I think what has brought about this is a failure to differentiate between the aspirations and the values which Mandela stood for. Mandela, for example, he fought for democracy. In the feeling of Mandela, democracy was the basis for the other aspects to go on. We needed to start with democracy in order to be able to address social and economic justice. The world had moved so fast. He knew that himself and his generation may not be able to go into that social and economic justice, which is a complex part of it. That is why he laid down the foundation for democracy. In democracy, what do we mean? Under Mandela, the basis of democracy was to establish institutions, independent institutions, which could facilitate the exploitation of both natural and human resources, which would facilitate equal opportunity for all. So by laying such a foundation, Mandela knew that as far as the aspects are concerned, if you have got a society where opportunities are opened for all, where there is respect of law, where there is independence of institutions which people can run to, then another generation will tackle the social and economic justice.
Suleiman Mugula is an independent political analyst. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Durban, South Africa. Meanwhile, much is known about Mandela's public life and principles. Until now, there has been scant knowledge of his intimate struggles as a husband and father behind bars. That changed this week with the publication of the prison letters of Nelson Mandela, 10 years in the making. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with the book's South African editor and an African-American commentator and attended a dramatic reading of Mandela's prison letters in New York.
A widely diverse crowd, black and white, young, old, and other, filled the Symphony Space Auditorium, eager to hear some of the previously unpublished letters Nelson Mandela had written from prison. The letters are drenched in powerful and inspired rhetoric. But there is heartfelt worry and concern for loved ones as well. Here is an abbreviated excerpt from a letter Mandela wrote on May 13, 1974, 10 years into his life sentence, as read by the actor Hisham Tofik. In it, Mandela implored South Africa's justice minister to allow Winnie Mandela, his wife and fellow activist, to be allowed to live with relatives or friends. It was her husband's third plea on her behalf.
She suffers from an illness which is caused by worry and tension and which has on occasions rendered her unconscious. Believe me when I say that I have, since September last year, lived in a real nightmare. I cannot get myself to accept that you could remain indifferent where the very life of another human being is actually involved.
For millions, Nelson Mandela embodied great ideals. Dignity, humility, perseverance, and after 27 years of harsh prison time, forgiveness. But, says Sam Venter, who edited the prison letters, the world tends not to dwell on what exactly it was that Mandela forgave.
And I think that these letters paint a picture of a life of more than 10,000 days behind bars that he had to endure really bad treatment and separation from his family. And that is what he forgave, so that he could come out and talk to his enemy, which he called them, so that the rest of us could live in a democracy eventually.
Tayari Jones is a creative writing professor at Emory University and the author of the novel An American Marriage, which examines the impact of incarceration on a prisoner and his wife largely through their letters to each other. Jones appreciates how Mandela's prison letters express the private side of this very public figure.
He was seen as superhuman. That was his image. That was how he operated symbolically. But when you read the letters, you see that, no, he's not superhuman. He's deeply human. Reading the prison letters made it so clear that separating a person from his kin, from his love, from his life, is really where the pain of incarceration comes from, and it's happening to millions of people all over the world.
At first, Mandela was allowed to write only one 500-word letter every 6 months. Many of those letters were heavily censored or shredded by prison authorities without explanation. He was not permitted to attend his mother's funeral or the last rites for his 24-year-old son, Tembe. Mandela's youngest children barely knew him before his release. They could not visit him until they were 16. Indeed, Mandela, the political prisoner, often posed an agonizing dilemma to Mandela, the loving family man, as we hear in this letter from April 1, 1971, as read by the actress Khandala Rashad.
There have been occasions where I wish I was born of an anthill or came from the legendary stork, when I wished I had no relations, never had a life companion, children, or family responsibilities. Repeatedly, I have asked the question, is one justified in neglecting his family on the ground of involvement in larger issues? Is it right for one to condemn one's young children and aging parents to poverty and starvation in the hope of saving the wretched multitudes of this world? These are questions that torment me daily.
Yet later in the same letter, Mandela indicates that his troubled preoccupation with those questions had finally dissolved
and led to greater certainty as to the correctness of my stand. I hope I have in the process gained a priceless reward, an objective and activated conscience the ability to dream of golden ages, to live for what could be. Yours affectionately, Dali Bunga.
These are words that continue to inspire in 2018, nearly 50 years after they were penned inside a prison cell, and 5 years after Mandela's death as a free man at the age of 94. As Sam Venter, the editor of the Prison Letters of Nelson Mandela, put it, the world we're living in is a darkening place. And if there is anything we can do to promote Mandela's legacy, it would be to try in our own way to do some good in our own communities and help to make the world a better place. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And right now, it's time for music from our African collection. Nipa maumivu kama nyangao na tena maumivu dawa ninywe vidonge kwa marafiki mashosti kanidharau kanitia uvivu stress niwe mnyonge ulienipa maumivu kama nyangao na tena maumivu dawa ninywe Rafiki mashosti ukanidharau Kanitia uvivu stressi niwe mnyonge Leo sina thamani ndo maana Unawafata miluko oh baba Leo sina thamani ndo maana Unawafata miluko oh baba Weni ache
Nitapona mdogo mdogo
Niache
nende sala Nitapona mdogo mdogo
Weni ache
Nitapona mdogo mdogo
Niache nende salama
Nitapona mdogo mdogo Nitapona
Mara ugomvi unakurupua unanitukana mimi Hata zawadi nikikuletea usemi asante Tena nashe hata bila kujua we uridhiki kwa nini Kuna wakati nilijisumbua mwenzangu usiwaze Wangu moyo we unauchanganya Umekuwa kivuruge unavuruga sana Baba we kitu gani kwako misijafanya Ama kuna mtu mnapendana sana Leo sina thamani ndo maana Unawapata my sister do oh baba Leo sina thamani ndo maana Unawapata my sister do oh baba we niache
nitapona mdogo
niache wewe niache
nitapona mdogo
niache wewe
nitapona
kidogo kidogo
nitapona mdogo
Tenga la Sandra Samye. Baby, I've been thinking about you. You know that I love you, baby. I'm phony one more, yeah, I want you, baby. I could do anything for you. Sandra Samye. My baby, I've been thinking about you. What is it that you done to me, oh? Eh, jelonga tabanga, sala tetanga. Did you pour me a love potion, oh? My babe, I can't stop thinking about you. Undenza Antonio, kuthenga la lepsuko. Estando sami. Undenza Antonio, kuthenga la lepsuko. Estando sami, baby, I've been thinking about you.
You, all that I need, baby, it's you. Oh, yeah. I cannot imagine life without you. Stand by some, I'm thinking about you. Ditala ni teta ni teta ngawe. Tala ni pupa ngawe. Oh, yeah. Oh, this is Antonina. I just can't stop thinking about you. Baby, all I want is you. Baby, there's no one but you. Go by, you give me the juice. You bring me the juice. On dance, I'm turning now. I just can't stop thinking about you. On dance, I'm turning now.
The melody I go to play you forever. Can't nobody treat you like I do, my baby.
Take you out tonight for a dinner. Doing things right,
like a dream man.
Is that I will be? See my baby, wanna give me. I know they said anybody, even when the things they waste were don't bully. Now then I go to love you better, treat you well. No matter the weather, you go bomb my tata. It's the dream of every man to get a fine girl like you. We go be like priceless you. Baby, me, I'm gonna make we the
love.
Keep us together. Can't nobody love you like I do, my baby. Oh, 1+1 is 1. Now it be the melody. I go to play you forever. Can't nobody treat you like I do, my baby. Oh, you are the personality, the sugar in my tea, my testimony. I see the probabilities equal to unity of our matrimony. This love is traced to the power of infinity. Girl, now you the ginger, my dignity.
That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdun, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaite, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, even the mightiest eagle comes down to the treetops to rest. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Fostering economic development in sub-Saharan Africa is a top priority of the United States, and the African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA, is the centerpiece of U.S. trade policy on the continent. The Trump administration places great importance on our relationship with Africa and sees genuine promise in the prospects for enhanced trade relationships with our partners, said Deputy Secretary of State John Sullivan. Speaking at the 17th annual AGOA Forum in Washington, D.C. in mid-July, Deputy Secretary Sullivan noted that the U.S. partnership with African countries is based on a number of strategic priorities. We work together to strengthen regional security, reinforce democratic governance, and increase trade and investment, he said.
We do all of these things because we understand that security and democratic institutions provide a stable foundation for economic growth and prosperity. At the same time, increased trade and investment are key to creating jobs and generating resources that strengthen security and democracy. When partners increase their capacity to confront real security challenges that we all face, we demonstrate how alliance building through economic cooperation promotes security.
Africa is the major market of the future, said Deputy Secretary Sullivan. Some of the world's fastest-growing economies call Africa home. We expect that over the next three decades, half of the world's population growth will occur in Africa. And that means a projected 1.2 billion new consumers will enter the African market, said Mr. Sullivan.
These trends, combined with Africa's growing youth population, will allow African countries to capitalize on a growing labor force. This great opportunity will come with challenges, however, including the need to provide jobs for this growing population. Expansion of trade and investment will be critical to meeting this challenge.
The United States applauds efforts such as the signing last March of the African Continental Free Trade Agreement framework because it advances another key component, regional integration. The United States stands ready to partner with African countries that are committed to reducing barriers to trade and investment, said Deputy Secretary Sullivan. In doing so, we hope to encourage policy reforms that increase openness and competitiveness within Africa and promote greater prosperity and higher living standards across the continent.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.